Information-fueled, opinion-driven. This is the Dan Mandis Show, Super Talk 99.7.
Man, oh man, you know, we've heard of women scorned, but wait till you hear this. For the love of Pete, man, a Broward County, this is in Florida, a Broward County elementary school teacher who tried to get revenge against her husband. You know, did she key his car? Maybe did she let the air out of his tires? No. You know what she did? She tried to get revenge against her husband by tipping off drug dealers that they were under investigation. And a guy actually got killed. One of the informants working with the police got killed because this soon-to-be ex-wife of this guy spilled the beans on the whole investigation. Holy mackerel. So now this woman may get 8 years in prison, as she should. I mean, you could perhaps maybe say that she should be charged. Well, maybe she is. Maybe she's charged in the death of the guy who was outed because of her loose lips sinking ships. The undercover investigation was compromised, and an insider informant who was secretly working with federal authorities was outed. He died of a gunshot wound a short time later under suspicious circumstances that were officially, quote-unquote, ruled a suicide, but they're thinking this guy got, you know, probably killed by the drug dealers. So the lady's name is Portia Session, 31 years old, and she's saying now that she acted naively to retaliate against her then-husband, a Lauderhill police detective who was involved in the investigation because he was cheating on her. So I guess you could say a couple of different things here. One is, well, police officers, if you're listening, may not be a good idea to tell the spouse that all of the details of your work because you never quite know what's going to happen. And also, don't cheat. Session told prosecutors that she wanted revenge against her philandering police officer spouse. And so she said that she snooped in her now ex-husband's work email and found memos containing sensitive law enforcement information about the investigation, the suspects, and the fact that agents had an informant working inside the group. The husband didn't tell her what was going on with his investigation. She was probably snooping around his computer because she thought that he was cheating. And so she was looking for proof of that and found all of the contents regarding this investigation. Holy mackerel. I mean, what kind of woman does that? What kind of person does that? I don't want to be sexist about it, but what kind of person does that? She admitted earlier this year that she made 6 phone calls to one of the suspected drug dealers and convinced him that an insider was helping law enforcement. She's now pleaded guilty to federal obstruction of an official proceeding, a grand jury investigation. So now, and she was working, by the way, as a fourth grade teacher. Now she is ultimately going to end up going to, and she should end up going to jail for doing what she did. Because that's, I mean, good Lord, man. I saw that headline. I was like, really? There is a number of different stories that I will call not exactly unifying, but I'll go ahead and share them with you anyway, because I think that one of the recurring themes we have in America today is the fact that the left is called the unity party, if you will, and we all know that it's not. There is a teacher, a college professor in Connecticut, and apparently wrote on a social media post, you ready? Let white people effing die. Doesn't that just make you feel warm and cozy all over? Less than 1 week after a gunman opened fire on more than a dozen Republican members of Congress on that Virginia baseball field, this Connecticut college professor said that first responders to the shooting should have let them die because they're white. In a Facebook post on Saturday, this was last weekend, Trinity College professor Johnny Eric Williams shared a Medium post titled "Let Them Effing Die," and this is all coming out now on from our friends at Campus Reform, who find all of these different little nuggets for us. And the reason why it's important is because how many times have we talked about over and over again what's happening in the colleges? And this is yet another example. But this is also happening in social media. There was a story; it was earlier this week. and not only social media, but also on the networks. It was, Jiminy Crickets. Was it CNN or was it MSNBC? I'm, to be candid, having a hard time telling them apart. There was a anchor on one of the different stations, and it was either CNN or MSNBC. And she was talking about how Steve Scalise, who, as we know, at the time, he's doing better now, but at the time he was fighting for his life. And he's being called by this particular anchor a racist and a sexist and all these other things because of the various bills that he's voted on and so forth. But when you think about it, and when you think about the fact that this college professor said through the social media post, "Let white people effing die," I guess I'm becoming more amused and bemused by these various headlines as opposed to getting angry, because I used to get angry. I mean, you know, I used to get angry. But the more that I read these headlines, the more I feel like it's just humorous. And I know that there's nothing humorous about it, but I just can't help but laugh. In a way, I think it's almost like, gallows humor. Maybe it's because I'm a talk show host and I'm mired in this stuff on a daily basis. And so when I read these stories, I think, holy mackerel, how is it possible that when you see these kinds of stories, you think, how is it that these folks who say these kinds of things, they get no punishment, they suffer no consequences, they have no ramifications? Now, for the record, I know the answer to that question. One, it's because he's a college professor, and we know what happens in the colleges. We also know, by the way, that this is in New England. You know, Connecticut, they're notoriously liberal, right? And I also know all about First Amendment rights, freedom of speech, all that good stuff. And so they're allowed to say what it is that they want to say and oftentimes suffer no consequences because it's all about their right to free speech. And I get it. I really do. But at some point, some sanity has got to come back to America as it relates to dialogue. In other words, instead of talking about, for example, with this guy, Johnny Eric Williams, the guy that said that the first responders should have let the white people die, instead of engaging in a reasonable discussion or a reasonable debate about the issues of the day, this is what he came back with. And then it makes you wonder, well, gosh, I wonder why it is that I've seen a couple of different polls this week, and I'm quite frankly bored with the conversation. And I think it's just a sign of the fact that I do what I do for a living, that I'm tired of seeing the same stories ad nauseum because there's nothing new here. And I think that when I saw the poll that showed that, what was it? I don't know. I think it was 79% of Americans think that the conversations and the dialogue here in America is divisive. And basically, I'm shooting from the hip on this. I barely read the headline, but basically it's divisive and it's not helping. Well, I want you to think about the last time you heard either the president or most Republicans say anything as horrific as that. Meantime, over on the left side of the aisle, we still have the screams of racism, the screams of sexism, Trump has to go, impeachment, tax returns, Black Caucus not going to meet with President Trump, and it goes on and on and on and on. And so I guess the question would be is, at what point do we stop talking about the dialogue and just start moving on with the business of, you know, making America great again? Well, there are signs that the Democrats are realizing just that. That they do need to focus on what is really happening in people's lives. And I spent a bit of the last hour talking about all of the things that the Democrats are doing wrong. And it's okay. I know. I'm still getting the emails. Don't worry. They're not listening to me. Although if they would, I'd really appreciate it. But they're not. Because I went in detail, excruciating detail on all the things that I think that they need to do to start winning those special elections. And they're not going to start doing the things that they need to do because of the fact that name calling is in their DNA. It's in like their party DNA. But there are some people apparently who are realizing now that the Democrats are nowhere near ready to make adjustments. And part of the reason why I can say to you that is because of the fact that they're having trouble raising money. So all the people who have been doing everything they can to raise money for the Democrats, for the midterms, and of course for 2020, people aren't buying it. The Democrats aren't buying it. The donor class of the left, whether it's Hollywood or whatever it is, they're simply not buying it. Listen to this. This is from April. The Republican National Committee raised $9.6 million and had $41.4 million on hand in April, according to newly filed FEC reports, while the DNC raised $4.7 million and had $8.8 million in the bank. Now, do you realize the disparity here? Do you realize the fact that Republicans have $41.4 million in the bank and Democrats have all of $8.8 million in the bank? Now, you could possibly say, well, it's because they're spending all of this money on all of these special elections like the one that we saw in Georgia. Okay, I can give you that. And what did it get them? It got them nothing. They're 0-5. But you can also look at the fact that in the month of April alone, I guess we don't have May yet. But in the month of April, the Republicans raised what looks like almost double what the Democrats made. So I guess the question is, one of the rather amusing things that I've noticed as I watch the headlines is the fact that you always have the media saying, oh, you know, the Republicans, they're trying to figure out whether or not they should mention Donald Trump on the campaign trail. And we saw that in the special elections, right? Should Karen Handel mention Donald Trump's name on the campaign trail? Because there's a lot of discussion as to whether or not she was supposed to embrace Donald Trump, or should she not embrace Donald Trump? Now, and I'm not in Georgia, clearly, but one of the things that, as I've read about this, I've noticed is that the Republican, Karen Handel, she sort of kept President Trump at arm's length. But I would say that the reason why she won wasn't necessarily by keeping President Trump at arm's length, but more because she was more focused on the issues. Because let's face it, if you bring up President Trump during the special election there in the 6th Congressional District there in Georgia, in the northern Georgia suburbs, right? It's a big, big story this week. If you bring up Donald Trump, then the question has to be asked, okay, you're bringing up Donald Trump. Are you talking about the issues that are critical to folks there in Georgia? And I would say the answer to that question is, even though you can frame whatever it is that you're saying in a certain way, probably not. Probably not. And so what Karen Handel did, the Republican, and how she ended up beating John Ossoff was, as Ossoff was talking about President Trump and all the blah, blah, blah. Karen Handel was talking about the issues the Georgians really cared about. And so she won. But I think the important thing to note is a couple of things. One is that the Democrats, you know, they never even forced that dude, John Ossoff, to live in the district, which, you know, for the record, in Georgia, you don't have to live in the district. And so Ossoff, I guess he lived, I don't know, 5-10, whatever it was, a few miles away from the district. And so he never bothered to move into the district. And so Karen Handel at one point looked at John Ossoff and said, well, who are you going to vote for? Because he couldn't vote, because he didn't live in the district. It was a very powerful moment. And so simply from a strategic standpoint, the Democrats are making mistake after mistake, right? Because think about it this way. Think about the fact that there was tens of millions. I've seen anywhere from $30 to $50 million that was spent by the Democrats. So you spent $50 million. Let's just go with a higher number because it makes a better story. Whatever. Sorry. $50 million that they spent on this campaign. You couldn't afford to spend, a couple of grand a month on an apartment so that he would move into the district. I mean, think about the stupidity of that. Now, I realize that if he decided to run And then he immediately, or shortly before, he immediately got an apartment in the district. Then the Republicans would have the ability to say, this guy's a carpetbagger. You know, he just moved into the district, and now he's saying that he's going to run. It's a carpetbagger. So instead, what he decided to do was not move into the district. Now, the answer to that whole carpetbagging question is, you're right, Republicans. I did just move into this district, and the reason why I moved into this district is because I care about this district. I care about the people of this district, and I really want to know the challenges that the people in this district are facing. So yes, I did. I moved into the district because I want to be part of a community that I desperately want to serve and desperately want to fix. I mean, I'm a knucklehead, and I did that on the fly. So when you think about the fact that the Democrats had all these people donating tens of millions of dollars, and they didn't want to spend a couple grand on an apartment so the guy could live in the district, to me is just an abomination. And that is like campaign malpractice is what that is. And so it's no surprise when you see that the Democrats are now $8.8 million in the bank as opposed to the Republicans who have $41.4 million in the bank. And so I think that one of the things that we're seeing is the fact clearly that all across America, we are seeing the usual hysteria and hysterical headlines, either in the media or on the college campuses or whatever it is. All the different places that we've just CNN, MSNBC, blah, 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 blah. We're seeing the same headlines, but there are a few voices, including one in the New York Times, by the way, and they're saying, listen, fellow Democrats, we need to chill out. We need to find our message, and our message is not Hillary Clinton. Our message is not that the Republicans are trying to starve children and kill old people. And I think people are becoming smarter than that. And I think that's probably why you saw a bunch of folks who came out for Obama did not come out for Hillary Clinton. I also think, and I talked about this yesterday, and I'm going to have to do this off of a sort of memory. But I was talking about in detail the John Ossoff, a Karen Handel, 6th congressional district in a Georgia race that was very important on a Tuesday. And I was talking about it yesterday. And one of the things that I said was the Democrats made the same mistake that they made in the general election with Hillary Clinton as they made there in the special election in Georgia. And that was a lot of people were focused on the fact that the demographics of that particular district have changed. And Newt Gingrich was in that particular district for, what, 20 years? And it was, quote unquote, mostly white. And now they've got, you know, a lot more diversity in that particular district. And so the Democrats thought, well, we've got our diversity. You know, they're rubbing their hands together. Oh, we've got some diversity now in the sixth. And so we can maybe retake that seat. Counting on the fact that because there's more black folks and because there's more Hispanic folks in that particular district, they thought they had a chance. And all they had to do was play the R card, the racism card, and the S card, and the racism card, and the misogyny card, and all the other cards that they play. And it's like the easiest common denominator kind of a campaign that you can run. And despite what they did with Hillary Clinton, and despite what they realized with Hillary Clinton, they have the same kind of campaign with John Ossoff. And ultimately, they lost because they were counting on and they were banking on, literally banking on this quote-unquote diversity, this newfound diversity there in the 6th congressional district in Georgia. They were counting on that to bring them a congressional seat, and they were sorely mistaken. Now, everybody's making a big deal about this whole – I've got an interview on this, I think tomorrow or Monday, on this whole Supreme Court going to look at the whole gerrymandering issue. Okay, that's fine. We can look at the gerrymandering issue, and that's all good and well. But don't discount the fact that you still have to appeal to and reach those people who are incredibly, incredibly angry at you as a party, I would say, to the Democrats. And so you can – try and prevent gerrymandering all day long if you want, and that's all fine and well and good and well. And I know that this is a very complicated issue, but just because you work on the gerrymandering issue doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to reach the people that you're trying to reach. Because thus far, if the election of 2016 and the special election of 2017 are any indication, you have not. 124 on Super Talk 99.7 WTN. Well, it's either good news or bad news. 135, Super Talk 99.7 WTN. I almost don't even know if I want to go into this all that much. But as you know, the discussion draft has been released by the Senate, and they're talking about what it is that they want to do with the repealing, quote unquote, the repealing and replacing of Obamacare. Now it's coming out that four senators are looking at this thing and thinking, you know, maybe we're not going to stand by this, but they are names that I trust, and I think that you trust as well, to make sure that the Senate, quite frankly, doesn't do anything stupid. Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, Mike Lee out of Utah, and Ron Johnson as well. So these are folks, and you know my story, right? You know that I was a Ted Cruz supporter, and then I turned into, when Ted Cruz dropped out, then I became a Trump supporter because I was a never Hillary guy. But here's the problem for the Republicans. Here's the problem for Mitch McConnell. Problem is that he can only lose two of these Republicans and still get this through the Senate. So in other words, if you've got four of these guys that are not so sure about this draft, this discussion draft on the repealing and replacing, quote unquote, of Obamacare, well, the question is, are you happy or sad? Well, I will say this. If it's Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, Mike Lee, and Ron Johnson, then I'm all for the discussion of this draft, if I can be so bold. Now, here's the reason why. First of all, a couple of things are going on right now. You will notice that all across the media, they're saying that this is the plan. This is not the plan, folks. As a matter of fact, the Republicans, Cornyn, I think, came out and even said, look, this is not the final version. This is not what we've been, quote unquote, doing in secret. No. They came out with this draft, this discussion draft, and basically, yeah, they did this part in secret, but they're not looking to pass it today or tomorrow. They're looking at next week. But the whole point has been, because, you know, the media and the Democrats, they're all screaming and have been screaming about how the Senate Republicans are working on this, again, quote unquote, in secret. And my own two cents on that was, listen, what they want to do is they want to just get something down on a piece of paper and then hand it to not only their fellow Republicans, but also the Democrats as well. And they want to discuss this draft. And they've even been saying, listen, this thing is going to be amended. We can't tell you how many times. This is nowhere near the final version. So you know me. I hope you know me. I'm all about coming up with the right legislation. I'm all about coming up with the right bill, because guess what? If they don't come out with the right bill and the right legislation, then it's not going to pass the House of Representatives anyway, because the folks there in the House of Representatives, the Republicans, have been saying, look, if you don't come up with the right concepts for this quote unquote repealing and replacing of Obamacare, it's just going to die in the House of Representatives. As a matter of fact, there were four things, and I've got this somewhere in my stack of stuff. House Republicans warning the Senate, keep crucial conservative items in the health care bill. So let's go over this real quick. And again, I don't want to delve into too many details here because, frankly, it's all going to change. But one of the things, and I mentioned this before, is that, and I even think I mentioned this to Scott Desjarlais a couple of different times, was I was offended at the attitude that the Senate had when the House of Representatives, the Republicans, came out with their version of Trump care, Republican care, whatever you want to, health care reform, whatever it is you want to say. And they sort of patted the Republicans in the House on the head and said, well, thanks, we'll take it from here. And you even had people that were in the Senate that were very just arrogant about the whole thing. You remember that whole thing. So anyway, so now I find it interesting and funny that the House of Representatives are now saying to the Senate, now that it's the Senate that's under fire, saying, well, listen, this thing has to have a certain amount of XYZ or this thing's just going to die with us. So here's the full story, and I'm going to get you right up to speed, which the news alerts just went out literally a couple of minutes ago talking about how these four key senators are not so sure about this plan. Senate Republicans' proposal to replace Obamacare would provide, and this is probably what Ted Cruz and Rand Paul and Mike Lee and some of these other folks have a problem with, because it would provide an additional $50 billion over 4 years to stabilize the insurance exchanges and a number of other things. And let's face it, the Republicans have been criticizing all of these subsidies for quite some time. I mean, ever since Obama came out, we haven't liked the subsidies, right? The plan released earlier today after months of closed-door meetings, I actually got this from Fox News, includes $15 billion a year in market-stabilizing funds over the next 2 years, $10 billion a year in 2020 and 2021, again, to stabilize these exchanges. These payments would come in addition to cost-sharing subsidy payments, which would be extended through 2019. It would also provide $62 billion allocated over 8 years to a state innovation fund, which can be used for coverage for high-risk patients, reinsurance, and other items. And it just goes on and on. But the important thing to note is that it's a 142-page discussion draft. And so this, I wouldn't be surprised, as a matter of fact, if I came on the air tomorrow and this thing is already amended 15 times, which is, again, why I don't necessarily want to spend a boatload of time on it. It does repeal the individual mandate, apparently, and I'm trying to, Bill, can you get a confirmation for me on this? Because this is driving me bat crap crazy. Does the Senate version of the bill strip funding for Planned Parenthood? Just somebody tell me, because I can't seem to get an answer on this, at least.
For 1 year.
Oh, it does for 1 year. That's it? And then after that year, funding for Planned Parenthood starts up again? Is that?
I don't know the specifics. I just read that it was going to be pulled for 1 year.
Okay. Well, you know, that's why I can't figure out what the answer is, because apparently it's a little bit of both. Well, pulling the funding for Planned Parenthood is one of those things that the Republicans in the House of Representatives say, listen, you've got to pull funding for Planned Parenthood. Now, I would say a year. Why would you pull it for just a year? If you could pull me the entire story, Beelzebub, that'd be appreciated. Thank you very much. The other thing it does, it creates a new system of federal tax credits and subsidies to help folks buy health insurance and offer states the ability to drop many of the benefits required by Obamacare. It does offer more financial assistance to some lower-income people to help them defray the rising costs of private health insurance. It goes on and on. These are all things that are basic tenets of what we've been looking for as far as the repealing and replacing of Obamacare. The big question is, does it go far enough for the likes of Rand Paul and Ted Cruz and Mike Lee? It doesn't sound like it does. It also is going to phase out the extra money that the feds have been giving to states as an incentive to expand eligibility for Medicaid. That's been a big issue, and also puts Medicaid on an actual budget. So right now, basically, with Medicaid and the expansion, there really is no budget. So now the pressure will be on the states, really, to figure out what to do with health insurance. But again, this thing is going to be changed a bazillion different ways. It is, of course, being called a tax cut for the rich, because the Senate legislation repeals the tax increases imposed by Obamacare. And to pay for it, they are making some cuts to Medicaid. Now, the question is, and this is one of the reasons why this has always been so frustrating with me, is that when you read, and I didn't have a chance before I went on the air today, because this came out a little bit before I went on the air, so I haven't had a chance to read the entire 142-page discussion draft, but it just depends on what side of the aisle you're on as far as how you dissect and represent and present these kinds of stories, right? Because if you say that it is a tax cut, quote-unquote, for the rich, well, then obviously you're somebody who is on the left. But, you know, for me, I would say, you know what, this is any kind of a tax cut, which is going to help, quote unquote, the rich or, quote unquote, the middle class or anybody hold on to more of the money that we earned ourselves, and it doesn't give a whole bunch of subsidies to other folks, then I think it's a good thing. Anytime a tax cut is a good thing, is a good thing. Anytime there's a tax cut. Now, no, I don't want small children to die. No, I don't want to starve old people. I want a system that works. And I don't want to be called any kind of any myriad of names that we get called every time we have this conversation about repealing Obamacare. And listen, I've been saying for how long now? It's not like they're trying to repeal something that is working. They're trying to save it. And you know my official talk show host opinion on this whole thing. I would rather see the Republicans just let Obamacare completely wither out and die instead of trying to repeal and replace it. Because no matter what the Republicans do, and I could sit here and I could read you another 2.5 pages of what's in this thing. But ultimately, the question is, does it matter what the Republicans do? No, it doesn't. Because the narrative will all be the same. And that is that the Republicans essentially took away health care for millions of people. Well, guess what? If there's no longer a mandate, then they're not taking it away. What you're doing is you're giving people a choice as to whether or not they want or even can afford health care. So right now, what they're trying to do, what the Republicans are trying to do in a number of different ways, is they're trying to fix a broken system. And they're trying to fix a system that has been broken by the left. They're trying to fix a system that was conjured up by the Obama administration, and then they, the Democrats, voted this thing into office. They didn't read the bill, and now here we are at a point in time here on June, what is it, 22nd of 2017, where finally we're trying to figure out as a nation and as a party, how do we fix this thing? And how do we fix this thing in such a way as to where we don't get hit politically? And I don't know the answer to that question, because as I've said now a bazillion times, I'm against what we're doing right now anyway, because I want to see the whole thing wither and die. And then the Republicans could come in and save the day. But we know what the narrative is going to be. We know that it's all going to be about tax cuts for the rich and taking away benefits and health insurance for the middle class and the poor and all this other kind of nonsense that we hear every single time. Now, the big question is, will it pass the Senate? Mitch McConnell has been working on this behind closed doors. We know that both sides of the aisle have been bat crap crazy pissed. And as I said before, you can only afford to lose 2 votes from Republicans. And right now there's 4 Republicans in the Senate that are backing away from this and saying, you know what, might not be for us. Now, Democrats have been calling for, and this is, of course, Chuckie Schumer and everybody else, Democrats are calling for this Obamacare replacement to be made public for at least 72 hours and be subjected to a CBO analysis and cost implications. Now, for the record, I'm all for that. And if that makes, you know, me whatever, well, then so be it. But I do want to know, and listen, I know that a lot of this analysis from the CBO can be discarded. I know that they have been wrong a time or two. But still, in this situation and in this world today where it is a battle over the narrative, it makes sense for the Republicans to allow for that CBO analysis and the cost implications. Now, if I remember correctly, and I'm trying to wipe the cobwebs off my brain from way back when, but if I remember right, the House version came out, and they said that it would, all these millions of people would end up being dropped off of their health care. But then you looked at the analysis of the CBO, and as I mentioned earlier, it was all about people who would choose not to be on Obamacare because the mandate was no longer there. And also what they didn't take into account was the fact that there are millions of people in America where if Obamacare continues, then they're just simply not going to be able to afford the health insurance because of the fact that the premiums are skyrocketing and there's all these different providers are pulling out of states. We all know that. But we also found out that it would also cut taxes, and that was a huge benefit to the House version of the replacement for Obamacare. So I'm all for the Democrats and the Republicans waiting for the CBO analysis and the cost implications. If this is what the Democrats want, then fine, give it to them. But the Republicans are trying to remind everybody this is a discussion draft. and is still being amended. So what they're saying basically is, here it is, let's talk and adjust. So there was no real secret process. They were getting words and ideas on paper, and they've been speaking to a number, the folks who put this together, they've been talking to a number of different people. Now, one of the interesting things about this is that you remember when the House was working on their version, right? And you remember the stories, because I told you about the stories, where you had President Trump and Mike Pence, they were both really twisting arms, and they were really hands-on with this thing. And all of that work was for naught, at least for the House of Representatives and the conservatives there, because it ended up going to the Senate. And the Senate, you know, said they were going to basically blow off what the Republicans in the House did. However, from all the analysis that I'm reading, there's a lot of similarities between these two bills. But President Trump apparently had nothing to do with what the Senate has now come up with. Apparently nothing. So in other words, the president has been incredibly hands-off. The Senate is going to have to own this thing. And so as the Senate is now required, because the president has nothing to do with this per se, and the House, you know, some of these concepts and some of these principles in the House version is now in the Senate version, the big question is, will they be able to reach a consensus in the Senate, and then will the House of Representatives, will they also pass this? And then on it goes to eventually President Trump. So we'll have to find out what happens, but it is a razor-thin margin there in the Senate, because we've got these, again, these four, and you're going to see all your news alerts, and this has basically been breaking news over the past 15, 20 minutes, is we've got Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, Mike Lee, and Ron Johnson, four senators, and I don't know a lot about Ron Johnson. I know a lot about Mike Lee, certainly Ted Cruz and Rand Paul. These are names that I trust. And so if Rand Paul and Ted Cruz and Mike Lee, if they sign off on this thing, that's going to go a long way for me, and I think that's going to go a long way for a lot of the folks listening as well. My name is Dan Mandis right here on Super Talk 99.7 WTN.